The Record Podcast is supported by Sound Solutions, providing counseling and therapeutic services to help with life's challenges such as depression, anxiety, addiction, and more, with personalized care that helps patients restore balance to their lives. With 7 locations serving King County, more at soundsolutions.health. Sound Solutions. Care today.
Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Could you imagine the Seattle Central Library burning up from the inside? And virtually no one outside our city knowing about it? That happened in downtown Los Angeles, where writer Susan Orlean sets her new book. She is the New Yorker staff writer who wrote The Orchid Thief. Susan Orlean coming up a little bit later on this program. I hope you can stay tuned. First, of course, our top story. Never before has a Democrat gone to Congress from our Cascade District number 8, but this state is resorting itself. And so far, Democrat Kim Schreier leads Republican Dino Rossi by 6 points.
I will hold town halls. You will know where I stand. I will listen to you, and I will be your champion in Congress. I love you, too. So we've got a lot of work to do. First, we need to make sure that every vote is counted. And when they are, I believe we will have a woman doctor in the House.
This district straddles the mountains from the growing suburbs of Easton, King, and Pierce counties over to rural Chelan and Kittitas counties. Here to talk about that race and more about this election is Seattle Times op-ed columnist Melissa Santos. Welcome back, Melissa.
Hi there.
Republican strategist Randy Pepple, founder of Pepple Communications. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Democratic communications strategist Kathy Allen, president and owner of the Connections Group.
Hey,
welcome back.
You got it.
Kathy and Randy, you both sat here, a couple of months ago or so and told me Dino Rossi would win. What have you learned today?
I learned that actually when you say those things just to get, people thinking that you really aren't going to go out there and work on, that forever. The fact is that race ended up having more people working that I would never have believed. People I could not believe were Democrats would be coming over from Bainbridge in en masse to be able to go over and do phone banks.
Why? In one sentence, why?
Because she became the issue that was our message. If she could win, then the forces of good might greet her.
Randy Pepple, what say you?
Well, one, the race is still up in the air until we see the next round of results. It's a big hill to climb. But in the eventuality that Kim Schreier does win, I think the amount of money that came into the race is going to be the defining factor. They're saying over $28 million spent between the two campaigns and the third-party groups that were supporting or opposing the candidates. And I think that's what changed the dynamic.
So you're denying a blue wave. You're saying it's a green wave of money, and this is not an important political shift?
I don't think the significance of the political shift is there as much as the money was there.
Well, when you talk about the money being there, I guess we'll have to just remember that when we get to talking about the carbon tax and the millions and billions that came in regards to that.
Oh, we will. Yes, carbon tax coming up. Melissa Santos.
When I saw Dino Rossi's results in the primary, 43%, with someone with that kind of name recognition in our state, I thought that was really bad. And I was not certain he could come back from that. And it turns out he couldn't. And I think part of it, he's running the same campaign he ran three times before. It strikes me, we're hearing about the same 2003 budget. For people who are young, and it does seem like we might have fairly high young turnout, a budget in the state from 15 years ago, and I cover the legislature. It's still just not that people. It doesn't connect with young voters at all.
Doesn't. She's right, but that we did see a big change this time. One of the biggest message things that happened is that anyone who had the experience and had served in public office before usually got the benefit of that. Not so this time. What's happened is that you were classified as old. You were part of the problem. You were that rascal that, I thought was going to be my rascal at least. But no, there was a backlash against anyone who was an incumbent.
But it was also against bipartisanship. Dino Rossi talks about the 2003 budget as a means of talking about reaching across the aisle and working with people of the opposing party. And in this election, that is not what the voters wanted to hear.
Okay, we talked a little about how this district, the 8th district, has not sent a Democrat to Congress before. Was there anything you found interesting in Washington State in our political sorting, our political momentum? What's happening that's most important in Washington State, Melissa?
It's been commented before, not the first person to say it, but you saw it in those 8th district results that King County, which is the majority of votes in the 8th district come from King County, where Schreier won overwhelmingly. That really overtook everything. And I think I haven't looked at all the precinct results yet. I'll take a day or two for that. But it looks like Rossi even did poorly in his former, in places where he lives, in Sammamish, where he normally previously has done well.
But you'd expect Western Washington to be more liberal than Eastern Washington. Is it more than that?
It is, because the thing is, the suburbs used to be a place where moderate Republicans could thrive in King County.
Uh-huh.
And we saw it's really tough territory. You see all that in legislative races, too. Some moderate Republicans who are well-liked, I would say, too. Paul Graves, for instance, in the Issaquah area, which overlaps with the 8th. Mm-hmm. He cannot pull out a win, even though he's probably as far away from a Trump-style Republican as you can find. And I think we are seeing a shift in the suburbs, and I think some of it is a demographic change and not just moderates getting knocked out by a wave election.
Yeah, I mean, this is not your grandfather's or even your father's 8th congressional district. I mean, as someone who worked on the 1986 race in the 8th congressional district and the 88 race, this is a far different district. And it's what Melissa just said. The suburbs have gone Democrat in a big way.
And not just Trump revulsion.
No. This has been going on over the last 30 years. I mean, when I did the 1986 congressional race there, Mercer Island was solidly Republican. I mean, there was one precinct that was under 70% for Rod Chandler when he was running then. Now, Mercer Island solidly Democrat. Bellevue has become much more Democratic. And now we're seeing extended out onto the Sammamish Plateau in the 5th District, as Melissa noted.
And what's the biggest reason that matters to our listeners?
I think it's because as we get more and more educated, then we become more and more Democratic.
That's wrong. I mean, the point is that it's just extending the Democrat control into additional legislative districts, whereas they've lost some of that control in Pierce County, which used to be solidly Democratic, is much more Republican now, has a Republican county executive, and in Snohomish County, where we're seeing more Republicans. So it's just where you have to move to find Republicans, you've got to drive a little bit farther than you used to.
I have to say that this is not really what happens. Is that every area except for Seattle usually has its pendulum swings, and what happens is that you just wait 4 years, and these will change again based on probably local taxes moving up. I have to say that I don't think that there's any rule that says an area is going to change and stay that way forever.
I think that you're also seeing, because, for instance, last year there was a huge state senate race in the 45th district, which is the east side suburbs. I don't think anyone thinks that's going to turn back Republican anytime soon. That's solidly Democratic, and some of it is immigration and different types of communities there. And we're seeing that in the Federal Way area as well, where a Republican state senator is down significantly.
Okay, before we leave Congress, just a couple of notes. In Eastern Washington, Kathy McMorris Rogers wins over the Democrat, Lisa Brown, 12 points. In Southwest Washington, Jamie Herrera Butler, again, incumbent Republican, 4 points up over the Democrat. Not the race hasn't been called yet, I don't believe.
I don't think it's going to be, too. I have to say that is a big one in terms of, if you took a look at what Randy was talking about, the number of counties that have not got even, I would say, a quarter of their votes actually counted. The fact is that Southwest Washington...
You're holding your hands to your head like you have a migraine.
No, I think it's good news.
Okay.
I'm trying to get this right. It's sort of like it's 28% was, I would say, Seattle, King County, managed to count up to like 50% of what they had.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is in some of these other, Pierce County being another, that's way behind. There's a lot more votes to come in there. The same is true with Southwest Washington.
Okay.
No, Jamie's safe in that district because Clark County's in it over 50%, and that's where Long really needed to rack up her vote totals. And so the vast majority of those are in. What's going to be interesting is just how many votes are actually still out. I mean, according to the turnout report last night, we're looking at votes in hand, already counted and in hand, equal to the last midterm election, about 56%. But does that mean that we're going to go over 70%, or does that mean that people just voted earlier and we'll be somewhere in the mid-60s? Okay. And that remains to be seen.
So we'll find all that stuff out. I want to talk about state initiatives. What jumped out the most to you? Anyone, what's the headline from, we had four state initiatives?
The gun initiative, I expected it to win, but it won really resoundingly. And I think that does show that, for instance, at least at the state level, I don't think that the politicians are necessarily in step with where the sentiment is on gun control right now. Certainly it varies from different parts of the state, and King County drives that a lot for pro gun control measures. But it passed pretty successfully, really well, really strongly.
Actually, that has the largest gender gap we've seen on an initiative ever in Washington State. In terms of what we've got going right now, there are more women that from Eastern Washington, from Southwest Washington, from Southeast Washington, far more women. We're talking like 14% difference between women and men in regards to that initiative alone. And unlike what was the situation as it might relate to the carbon tax, where you might have thought women would be as adamant about environmental concerns, not so.
Well, and on the carbon tax, and full disclosure, I worked on the No campaign. To me, that was the biggest surprise, because that was one that was supposed to be coming down to the wire, and it's a blowout. And it's a blowout for Jay Inslee's biggest issue, the thing that he hopes is going to transform him into a national figure.
And, so much for his presidential run?
Well,
he's
running for energy secretary, not president.
Okay. Okay.
You know, the fact is that twice now voters have had an opportunity to tax themselves over carbon. Twice they've resoundingly said no. And the arrogance of the yes side is to, one, not concede, and two, to say, oh, we've got legislative champions who are going to push this next January.
What about that? What about the legislature that's got more Democratic now?
Do you think that if the people just voted down a carbon tax initiative twice, that every Democratic lawmaker is going to be rushing to pass it? I'm really not sure they will be. There certainly will be some who want to, but I wouldn't be surprised if they focus on other aspects of environmental policy that weren't just rejected by the people for a second time.
You know what? We have done not a darn thing about reducing the carbon usage, for goodness sakes. And the fact is that you can always shoot these things down by what they did a very good job. Randy did a good job of counting the money and putting it to make sure we confuse people. When you confuse people on an initiative, you vote it down. What happened in this case is that carbon initiative moved much closer to actually becoming something that people could talk about. As we see more and more young people actually voting, the huge gap in this one was the number of young people that were pro-carbon tax and the number of people anywhere over the age of 40 that were not. This is not going away. Like carbon itself, the carbon dioxide's not going away because nobody wants to address it. If any place takes that first step to do so, it'll be us. And frankly, I really believe it'll be the oil companies that will finally decide either you come up with something or we're going to have to play this game over and over again.
I don't think you're wrong, but I think that it's more likely, I mean, honestly, to have come up in a 2020 initiative when there's high youth turnout for a presidential year than in the legislature. The legislature is often content to let hard decisions go to the voters in our state. And I'm not sure they'll try to take this up again right away.
And Kathy, I'll have to say you are wrong about the campaign. The confusion was coming from the yes side. They didn't even put the text of the initiative up on their website.
Okay.
We were just trying to get them to read.
But you guys are truly fun. Oh,
but
funny.
But here's where I think it's going to come down to is in the legislature, if the Democrat majority actually wants to try to get something done, they will invite all the players into the table instead of trying to ram through, as they did with this, something that excluded most of the people impacted by the initiative.
To be fair,
they'll get it done.
They tried to run something in the legislature earlier this year.
Yes.
That had more that
several things.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of businesses also came out against that at the time too. So,
but they weren't at the table. I mean, the Democrats have tried to do it on their own. They're going to have to make it a much more bipartisan measure, because the fact is, Washington State's one of the cleanest states in the country. We're second in energy generation.
Here comes the
we
confusion
are.
Part.
Well, no, that's the truth part, Kathy.
No,
I hope that
not.
Isn't confusing
because
to you.
It is.
We are second in the country in terms of emissions on our electricity grid. Only Vermont.
Randy, the campaign
is
over.
Because of hydro. Have you heard
it's over, Randy. You guys won this one. I'm just going to argue
won with
for
the truth.
Fact
okay,
that we're not going to let
the truth
this
will set
away.
You free.
I will say that per capita wise, Washington isn't doing quite as well on emissions
you.
There.
Before Kathy and Randy go out for a beer together, because I know they're friends, anything you want to say about the national trend? And we're seeing. A Democrat majority now in the House, increasing Republican majority in the Senate. We're just seeing the U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has been fired, resigned at your request, Mr. President. What do you see? What's next?
Well, it was a pretty progressive year, even though nobody wants to talk that because, you know, Trump goes on blah, blah, blah for an hour. What happened is that, you know,
hey, that was our program.
Massachusetts actually, until the way they pulled the plug.
Massachusetts elected a Republican governor. We like that.
But it passed the first pro-trans ballot. We're talking about the others in terms of a first out gay governor. We're talking about that incredible vote suppression architect, Chris Kobach, gone. And taking a look in Kansas, taking a look at the first Native American, the first Muslim women. We're talking about Washington State's number of women is likely to be 42% in our legislature. However, in this country, what happened is that we had been number 104 in the world of 193 countries when it comes to women's representation in our top body. Guess what? We went up 26 positions, so that we are now right with Moldova at a mere 78. We're number 78 now. We picked up 26 places.
Randy, yes. What's your big USA takeaway?
Well, the big takeaway is we're going to have 2 years of investigations from the House and 2 years of personnel actions in the Senate and very little legislative action between those two bodies, with the possible exception of an infrastructure package that both can agree on. And the presidential race started today. That's why Trump spent over an hour in his press conference. That's where you're going to see Democrats announcing probably within the next month that they are running. And that's what's going to dominate the conversation. The Republican victories in the Senate, they picked up more than they would have thought they were going to do, even though it was a very tough map for the Democrats. And in the House, Democrats picked up fewer seats than they thought they were going to, although in a midterm, that was to be expected that they would take that step. What's interesting to me is Nancy Pelosi going to be the speaker, or the Democrats who said they weren't going to vote for her actually going to follow through with that commitment?
Okay, let's you take this over beers. Randy Pepl and Kathy Allen, thanks for joining us today. Kathy Allen, president, owner of the Connections Group, Democratic strategist. Randy Pepl, Republican strategist, founder of Pepl Communications. The Seattle Times' Melissa Santos is going to stay with us. Thanks for that moment, and we'll come back with more election coverage. Continuing our election coverage and analysis here on KUOW on the record, I'm Bill Radke with Seattle Times op-ed writer and longtime Olympia correspondent Melissa Santos, and KUOW's own Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins join us. Hi, Austin.
Hello, Bill.
So the big story of the night, let's see, Melissa, you said it was underestimating Republican enthusiasm.
I think that's true a little bit. We saw this really high turnout that seems like it might be rivaling, past midterm elections or setting a record. Certainly, it looks like we might be surpassing 2010 even or matching that. But leading into, it doesn't seem like Republicans stayed home. And we were hearing that a little bit coming into the election. But I do think we saw that in the legislature where the Republicans were down anywhere, depending on how you calculate, between 13 and 17 seats in the state House from the August primary, which was real bad. And now it looks like the Democrats may only gain 7 or so seats in the state House. So there's been definitely some enthusiasm and some work on Republicans' part to reverse their fortunes.
But Austin, Democrats did still increase their control of the House and hold control of the Senate. And why is that? Why does it matter?
Well, right. I think Melissa's right that they're looking at picking up about 7 seats in the House, understanding that many of these races remain too close to call. And in some cases, we're talking about 200 to 400 votes separating some of these candidates, and then a possible pickup of 2 Senate seats. So they build their majorities. They get past this one seat advantage that makes it very hard to govern. You know, you can't lose a vote within your own caucus on any bill. And so this gives them a little bit of wiggle room. And I think that we'll see Democrats assert their majorities in January, but with some limits, because they also realize if they overreach, they can be sent packing in 2 years. Here's what I'm watching for. Passage of a capital gains tax. And here's how I think they'll try to take the sting out of that. They will reduce state property taxes. They know that voters, especially in Central Puget Sound, are taking the brunt of that property tax hike for education funding. That was an idea that Republicans, when they controlled the Senate, came up with, and Democrats never really loved it, even though they went along with it. So I think that that's going to be the trade to watch for.
Do you think that will get through? I mean, that to some people, that's the income tax camel's nose under the tent. Do you think capital gains tax will pass in this state?
I don't think that there's a guarantee at all. And I, again, with these additional votes, additional seats that they have, that helps them. But there are going to be plenty of new arrivals to this legislature who are coming from districts that until yesterday were held by Republicans, moderate Republicans, who are going to say, in my first term in office, do I want to vote for something that is potentially as radioactive as a tax that Republicans immediately and have already labeled an income tax.
Mm-hmm. Also, I'm not sure that the amount of votes that the Democrats got in the Senate will overtake the existing moderates in the Senate that have been reluctant to vote for a capital gains tax. I think if they'd have to win maybe all four seats that are up in the air, not just the two in which they're ahead now, there's some barriers there.
I think they're going to. They may try. It's going to be a topic of discussion, but whether they will have the votes ultimately to do it. And again, the way that it seems like they might be able to sell it, even to the moderates in both chambers, would be the idea that it comes paired with property tax relief. But it's hard to imagine Democrats coming up with a revenue neutral option here, because they're looking for new revenue.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, you know, it's still going to be a tax increase, but they're going to say it's on the wealthiest Washingtonians who can afford to pay. And
sure.
They'll couch it also just in a broader conversation about tax reform, quote unquote.
Yes, regressive, progressive. And so the capital gains may be tax. What's another one, Austin?
Another one we're hearing about trying to address prescription drug pricing, or at least transparency around that. And that's something that Democrats feel like they have some mandate to address, just because healthcare was so on the minds of voters this year. And then you've been talking about the failure of the carbon fee initiative, 1631. Already, Joe Fitzgibbon, who heads the House Democratic Campaign Committee, he also chairs the House Environment Committee, is talking about how that defeat is going to galvanize them, as opposed to make them pack, you know, grab their marbles and go home. What's not clear to me is, are they going to go for pricing carbon, or are they going to look to things like a low carbon fuel standard, 100% renewables requirements, and move away from this idea of pricing? That seems to be the big question right now.
Now, Melissa, you were very skeptical about a carbon fee.
Joe Fitzgibbon is quite the optimist, and that's probably an asset in politics sometimes. I think they still have some barriers on the carbon tax, but they certainly will be talking about it and seeing what maybe can move. And same with the capital gains tax. It definitely is going to be a top topic of discussion. But a lot of their work is going to be kind of the same boring stuff that they've been doing. It's not going to be as fun as maybe some hope, even with some of these gains. They have a huge problem with fixing the state's mental health crisis, and that's going to be a top priority.
What are they going to do about mental health?
I believe that they're going to start trying to fund more beds in regional areas for people who are civilly committed, and shifting the sort of troubled Western State Hospital, which Austin knows a lot about, to being more just for forensic or sort of patients that are involved in the criminal justice system. But that means you have to invest in beds outside of just the state hospitals, and you have to find communities that are not going to, how do I say this nicely, rebel against having those in their communities. So that's, and they have some leftover work on education funding. So I still think that that's going to be sort of the top priority, even as some of these issues are playing out.
Let's get another word on this carbon fee that is going down. This is, we have Hal Burton here following the story for the Seattle Times. Welcome, Hal.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. We're wondering what this is strike two for a carbon fee in Washington State, and we're all wondering, you know, this is something the governor's tried to make a signature issue. Two voter initiatives now gone down. Now more Democrats in the legislature. What's your take? What's going to happen?
Well, I think we have to step back for a moment and realize that although the United Nations and others talk about carbon pricing as pretty essential to trying to reduce greenhouse gases globally, it's definitely a hard lift politically. And we've seen that not just in Washington state, but elsewhere where legislative bodies have tried to pass carbon taxes, although they have passed in, of course, British Columbia, and recently, more recently, Prime Minister Trudeau announced carbon taxes in Canada for the provinces that haven't come along with their own plans. So the idea is there. It's not going away. One last caveat is simply that the oil industry majors, BP and Shell, have repeatedly said that they embrace carbon pricing. BP was very much involved in the negotiations in the legislature last session, which actually exempted the bill that ended up in final form that never made it through, exempted their petroleum refineries from carbon emissions, which is something that the ballot initiative did not. So I believe that there will be at least some effort to go for another form of carbon pricing in the legislature next year. Certainly, I believe State Senator Reuben Carlisle will be up for that. Others may not. They may want to go for different approaches, more regulatory and such. But I don't think we've heard the last of carbon pricing, whether it's a fee or a tax or some other form.
This is going to be fascinating. Hal Burton from the Seattle Times, thanks a lot. Let's check in on some other state initiatives now. We have KUOW reporter Ruby DeLuna here, who's been following this. It's a ban on non-existent grocery taxes. Obviously, the grocery tax that we have in Seattle has been the soda tax, and opponents wanted to prevent more of those. And Ruby, what happened?
So it was defeated, it passed. It was defeated in King County and in Jefferson, but in other counties, it passed. And I think. You know, if you ask the yes side, they would say, look, voters really was taken, you know, it appealed, the message appealed to voters who felt like they were hit hard with the high cost of living. But I think money played a big role here. If you look at Oregon's initiative proposal, which is similar to the soda tax here, it was the same thing, but there was bigger funding here in Washington State. You had big beverage companies spending $20 million on
Pepsi,
this.
Red Bull.
Yes, exactly, compared to $13,000 on the No campaign here. Whereas if you look at Oregon's initiative, it was equal. Both sides had spent roughly the same amount of money. So in Oregon, it was defeated.
What do you think happens next on this issue, Ruby, of, as we said, non-existent grocery taxes and soda taxes?
So for one, Seattle soda tax will be left untouched. Right. And the next step could be that Reuben Carlisle, State Senator Reuben Carlisle, will try again to co-sponsor a proposal that would require the top five donors of, you know, initiatives to, you know, list their names and logos prominently in these in campaign flyers and ads.
Right. Reuben Carlisle comes up again. Maybe he can put a fee on the carbon dioxide that's in soda, a carbon dioxide fee.
I think the logo thing is a bit of a stretch from Reuben as part of his last minute push to say, hey, these soda companies really, really are bad. Vote this down. But I think there will be some campaign finance stuff that kind of goes to that next year.
Let's talk about another initiative we haven't said much about. These were the gun safety regulations having to do with minimum ages and safe storage. Initiative 1639, KUOW reporter Casey Martin has followed that. And Casey, what happened and why?
Hey, Bill. So, yeah, the 1639 did pass yesterday with a pretty good margin. And the three biggest changes are, you know, minimum age to buy a semi-automatic rifle has been raised from 18 to 21. It's one of the few states that has raised the age. Also, there's a 10-day waiting period. So if you want to buy a semi-auto, you have to wait 10 days. And then probably the most controversial is a safe storage law, that if you are not properly securing your weapon and it gets stolen and then that weapon is used to commit a crime, the owner of the weapon can actually be penalized. finalized. So those are the three biggest ones, part of 1639.
So this makes Washington State relatively progressive in America when it comes to gun control. What do you think those gun control campaigners want to do next?
Yeah, you know, what's next is, you know, first of all, they're just enjoying this. You know, this has been described as some of the strictest gun policy in the nation. And, you know, they're looking at closing some of the background check loopholes. That's also part of 1639, expanded background checks. Also investing in state research on gun violence, especially suicide. That's a big thing that keeps getting brought up a lot, is accidental firings of a weapon, also suicide, which are used with firearms quite often.
And on the other side, there are the gun rights people, Second Amendment activists, already planning to sue over this initiative. What's their case?
Yeah. Well, you know, as you might remember, Seattle and Edmonds have already passed secure storage laws, and they have both been sued by the NRA and the Second Amendment Foundation. And they are seething. They are just waiting to sue over 1639. I already spoke with a couple of Second Amendment rights activists before yesterday's vote. And the biggest ones, again, are the safe storage. You know, that's going to be a little ambiguous, you know, whether it's a trigger lock or a safe. And then if it does get used to commit a crime, that'll obviously be a lawsuit. And then, again, denying 18 to 20-year-olds the right to buy a semi-auto. People say, Second Amendment rights folks say, if somebody can serve in the military, then they should be able to buy a semi-auto. So those will be the two biggest ones, I think, that we'll see as far as lawsuits. And I spoke with Attorney General Bob Ferguson, State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, yesterday, who's no stranger to lawsuits, and said that he feels that this will be upheld in the courts. He's pretty confident about it.
Okay, that's a victory for the Yes campaign when it comes to some gun safety regulations, Initiative 1639 passing. We also have this state initiative about how we hold accountable police who use deadly force, and we have KUOW Amy Radel, who's been covering this Initiative 940. Welcome, Amy.
Hi.
What happened last night? And well, you know, it's not really last night in Washington State. We've been voting for days and days and days. But what happened in this election around police use of force, and why?
Initiative 940 is passing strongly as of last night's initial results, 62 to 38%. The crux of Initiative 940, I think, is the standard for charging a police officer for negligent use of deadly force. And basically, this initiative is going to bring Washington State in line with other states on its charging standard in those cases. And it also contains new requirements for training and also for independent investigations. When an officer uses deadly force, they're not going to be investigated by their own department under the language in this initiative.
And prosecutors wouldn't have to prove that an officer acted with malice to get a conviction.
Exactly.
So lowering that standard.
What a reasonable officer would have done in the same situation is going to be the new standard.
And this has been extra interesting because we don't know what the legislature is going to do now that this initiative passed. What do you think?
The voters have now made it more difficult for the legislature to modify it for the next 2 years because they would need a two-thirds vote in the legislature. They had a compromise that brought some of the police groups on board that even the backers say they would like to revisit. It's just going to be a little bit more difficult to modify the initiative for the next couple years because it passed.
Right. That's KUOW reporter Amy Radel and Casey Martin and Ruby DeLuna. And finally, we're with Melissa Santos from the Seattle Times. Any final words on election 2018, Melissa?
Not much. I'm focused on the state legislature and mired in spreadsheets, and I'll go back to them. It's aggravating waiting for results in Washington State, so we'll keep doing that for a few more days. But some of these initiatives are really decided really already.
Seattle Times op-ed columnist Melissa Santos and Casey Ruby. Amy, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to election coverage and analysis. It will continue. You know, we're going to get more election results. There are going to be more results coming today, and then a big amount of results coming on Thursday. So keep it here on KUOW Seattle. Back with Susan Orlean in just a moment. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There is a major moment in your childhood when you realize there is a place for you that's not your home. You belong in this place. You're happy there. You're growing up there. When I was 6 or 7 years old, there was one place my parents would let me ride my bike by myself. And I can still see my bike's kickstand going down in front of the building, and I can feel the air conditioning as I walk in, and I can hear the hush, and I can smell the carpet and the armchairs, and of course I can smell all of the books, the library books, shelf after shelf of Hardy Boys and dinosaurs and anything I wanted to get with my library card. And I get emotional still remembering how fulfilled I felt there. And I felt it again as I read the new book by New Yorker writer Susan Orlean. It's called The Library Book. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Do you get emotional too?
I do. I think libraries feel somehow almost sacred. They don't feel like anywhere else.
Yeah.
And when I walk into a library, the first thing I do inevitably is just to sort of gasp and this feeling of such bounty and the fact that all of these things are just there to be borrowed and looked at. There's something very, very unique and kind of otherworldly.
Yeah.
About the space of a library.
And even as a grown-up, it's a place where you are connecting with other people, with the librarians who know so much and with the authors, and you just feel like something is working and it's a happy thing.
Yeah, I think that one of the most enjoyable things that struck me while I was working on this book was that feeling of it being an ongoing conversation.
Hmm.
That these books were written, God knows when, as a way of kind of communicating with people. And then we share those books. So in a sense, we're kind of connecting with all the other people who have shared the same book. And the stories are being carried on from one person to another, from one generation to another. I think that's one of the elements that makes libraries feel so special, that sense of community and sharing.
Of all the places to burn down.
Really not what you would want to have in the same sentence, the word library and fire.
Yeah.
But I wrote about the largest library fire in the history of the United States, which was in 1986, the LA Library burned. It wasn't by any means the first library fire in the history of the world. In fact, libraries have been burnt since they've been built. But this was the biggest single fire in the U.S. And
I moved to L.A. maybe 10 or so years ago. I worked four blocks from the downtown library. I worked on 3rd and Figueroa. I went there many, many times. Beautiful place. Never heard about the library fire.
And that's a lot of why I wanted to write the book. I was fascinated that an event so epic, because it really was epic, somehow managed to be, in many instances, unnoticed or unheard of. And there are some reasons that that happened. And the most significant one, which I discovered when I first began researching this book, was that it occurred on the same day as the Chernobyl meltdown.
Yeah.
So just as today's news is dominated by the election and it's hard to notice anything else happening, on April 29th, 1986, the LA Library burned for 7.5 hours, lost or had damaged over 1 million books, but the world was watching Chernobyl.
Now, here's one place where we might disagree, Susan. I maintain that I never heard about this fire because, honestly, I mean, no one wants fires or arsons or book burnings, but it was just a library. It really wasn't that big a deal. If you have love for books, then you care about the bigger ideas around the fragility of the written word. But, Susan, it was just a library.
But what? Just a library? Oh my God!
They were just books.
Jump across the table and books. Strangle you.
But there were copies of all these books in other places.
There weren't.
They lost some cookbooks.
No.
But there's too many cookbooks in the world.
No, they lost many, many, many books that could never be replaced.
What was the biggest loss?
The only complete patent collection west of the Mississippi was lost. So until another one was purchased, there was no patent collection that anybody could look at. many of the books could not be replaced because they were out of print. They were not easily found again. And secondly, if you have $22 million sitting around to replace books in a library, you're a very lucky man. The city of LA was not so lucky, and the insurance covered the damage to the building, but it did not cover the books. So there was this crisis of how are we going to rebuild the collection?
Well, your book got me thinking about these questions about, what if somehow Shakespeare and Dickens disappeared? And I thought, you know, the one thing we have no shortage of, human beings, is stories. We would have new stories and more space for new stories to understand ourselves. But we might disagree.
Yeah, I don't think existing stories take up. I don't think it's a zero sum game. I don't think the existence of Shakespeare means there can't be another writer who tells amazing stories of families and power the way Shakespeare did. I think it's an aggregation of stories, and that, in fact, the writer working today who wouldn't have Shakespeare to turn to for inspiration would be in a less advantageous position than writers who can look back and read the great writing of the past.
This is Susan Orlean, one of our great writers, a New Yorker staff writer. You might know her for The Orchid Thief or Rin Tin Tin. I also had the sense that you were using the exploration that comes with writing a book to appreciate your new town. You moved to Los Angeles.
Yes, and I was new to L.A. when I first heard about the fire, so I knew in part my ignorance of it was. It made a little bit more sense because I was living in New York at the time of the fire. It was a great way for me to learn about the city because the growth of the library in many ways paralleled and reflected the growth of LA as a city. And it was really a wonderful way to get familiar with my new home.
And as you were, I was surprised that there was a palace of a library in downtown Los Angeles. And of course, yes, people in Los Angeles read, and you're delving into the written word and set in L.A. But Seattle really does read more than Los Angelinos, I think. I think that stereotype is true.
I don't think it's true.
Really?
No.
This is part of our identity in Seattle.
Yeah, and I'm not saying people in Seattle don't read, but I can't pull statistics out of the air, so I won't. Mm. But I will say that the idea that people in Los Angeles don't read was a lot of what appealed to me about doing the book.
Yeah.
Because I like saying to people, that's just a silly stereotype. Of course people in L.A. read.
Of course. I still think it's more of a reading town here. I couldn't quote you any statistics either.
Yeah, I can't, unfortunately. But at the time that the library burned, the use per capita in L.A. was the highest in the country.
Well, maybe it's the kind of books I imagine us reading, I imagine us delving more deeply in our cozy, cloudy, rainy.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that in a place with crummy weather, you may end up looking at indoor activity a lot more.
Yeah.
And LA does have fabulous weather, and it's hard sometimes to keep yourself inside when it's beautiful out. But I think the part of what I found very interesting was exploring and exploding a lot of the myths about Los Angeles.
What besides the they're shallow and don't read, what's the other biggest myth?
Well, I didn't even know LA had a downtown. So the fact that I was told, oh, there's a wonderful library downtown, my first reaction was, I didn't even know there was a downtown.
It was starting to come back when I moved there, but in the 80s when that arson hit, that wasn't much going on.
No, there really wasn't, though it is now an incredibly vital, vibrant part of the city. And certainly that comes as a surprise to just about everybody, but it really has been invigorated beyond anybody's wildest expectation.
And it's gorgeous. And by the way, Susan Orlean, her new book is The Library Book, great title. You are speaking at Seattle's Central Library downtown tonight at 7 o'clock. Right. Have you been to that library or seen that library before?
I've seen it, yes.
Also quite remarkable.
Amazing, really amazing, and really one of the places that I'm most excited to see in the course of this tour, which, while it's both working to promote my book, is privately giving me a tour of some of the great libraries in the United States. So I'm enjoying myself very much.
I'm really curious what you think. I don't know if I'm going to find out, but it's outside. It's very remarkable, of course, the angles and the glass and the steel. But I'm one of those who, of course, I thought, wow, I was wowed. I believe it was the Seattle PI famously had their architect revisit it a few years later after the wow and say, you know what, it's kind of cold. It's kind of impersonal. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to be 100% one way or the other on this unusual Seattle library.
Right. Well, I think that we all have an idea of a library as having a certain temple of knowledge kind of look,
mm-hmm.
with a big entryway and a kind of dark, somber, serious quality.
Yes.
And that, I mean, there are many, many libraries that look just like that, and they're kind of epic buildings. So sometimes going into a modern library is a little disorienting because you feel like you're walking into an art gallery.
Right.
With books. And it doesn't fit with that sense of a library as this dark, kind of warm, just a very different feel, though that's certainly an old-fashioned architectural notion of the way a library should look. But it's something that I think you have fixed in your mind what a library looked like when you connect it to the libraries that you went to as a kid.
The book is the library book, and it has this look of it's mute. I mean, it's very pretty, but it's muted. It, to me, it has the look of a book that used to have a cover on it.
Right.
Like all library books do,
yes.
Did at least when I was a kid, and now it doesn't?
Well, we decided to not have a dust jacket, which
right.
is very unusual.
A dust jacket.
And to make it feel and look a little bit more like a library book. And I think it's really a beautiful object. And that's another reason to have designed it the way we did, is to sort of remind us of the physical quality of a book and the kind of presence that a book has.
Susan, you're here on election day, as you know, and I was looking at your Twitter feed, and you tweeted, I will call anyone you know who isn't going to vote and urge him/her to reconsider. DM me name and phone, and I'm on it. Did you actually call anyone?
I did. Well, I did phone banking, but I didn't get. I had so many people retweet that comment, and yet nobody gave me anyone's phone number to call.
Oh, I should have done that.
Sorry, I would have done it, and I meant it very seriously. Instead, I spent much of yesterday doing phone banking to encourage, you know, get out the vote. Phone banking for happened to be in North Dakota, even though I was doing it from Los Angeles because we were just working the phones anywhere and everywhere that they were needed.
I know you're very passionate. I can tell about politics today. I don't know whether it makes you cry, but I did see that you host a podcast called Cry Babies.
Right. And we're on hiatus right now, but we did many, many, many episodes over the course of 2.5 years.
Interviewing people about things that make them cry in
culture.
Yeah,
music and movies and books and poems and paintings and ads. And I would say there are plenty of political commercials and political races that make me cry.
It made me think there's, because people came to you, you kind of wanted to know what made them cry. And I think most, well, sad things make me cry, but what's an unusual thing? And I what rushed back to me was how there was this scene in Sound of Music where the nuns sing, "How do you solve a problem like Maria?"
Right.
And she doesn't follow the rules, and she sings in the abbey, and one of the nuns kind of hates her, but mostly they're just wondering, how do you contain a joyful, unruly person and still nurture her? How do you, you know, catch a cloud and pin it down? And I thought, every time I see that, which my kids still love, I get weepy, and I think that's the weirdest song to get weepy about.
Except a lot, what makes people cry often is something about joy and wonder. And
yeah.
I would say, for instance, sometimes when I walk into a particularly beautiful library, I feel sort of choked up.
Yeah.
Because there's this sense of, oh my God, people made this. This is, we've done this thing, which is to create all of these books full of knowledge and stories and narratives. And now we've gathered them all in a beautiful place for people to borrow. And it just makes you feel like, oh my God, people are good after all, or there is goodness, or there are joyful things in the world. And I'm more likely to cry over that kind of thing than I am over something really sad.
I bet you've had lots of people besides me tell you that when you brought them back to their hometown branch library, that I certainly teared up over it, you know,
yeah.
Thinking through that, right?
Oh, I've had a lot of people tell me that the first 50 pages of the book, they were already in tears. And I think that, and that's certainly one of the big reasons I wrote the book, was trying to explore the emotion that we feel about libraries. Why are they so special? What is it that makes them so resonant for so many people? You know, you think, well, I went there with my parents, but you go to a lot of places with your parents and
yeah.
you don't feel that same attachment and emotion to them. And we as a society feel very emotional about books. That's why one of the first things an oppressive regime does is burn books, because it is so close to people's sense of identity that burning the books of a culture is a way of saying you don't exist. You will be erased from the world's memory. And it's really powerful. And that only would be that way if we had a special connection to books, and I believe we do.
Well, you might wonder why in the world someone would commit arson, would burn down from the inside one of our great and beautiful libraries, and that's also a big piece of this book that we won't spoil or capture now, but who and why. It's a human story. It's an LA story, and it's called The Library Book, from Susan Orlean, and she's speaking tonight at the Central Library in downtown Seattle at 7 o'clock. And it's been a real pleasure meeting you, Susan.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in today. The show is produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Allison Bruzek, and Sophie Reed. I'm Bill Radke. Join us again tomorrow on The Record.